Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, May 8th, 2013. I'm speaking loudly and clearly so that Big Brother can capture every word.
Hello. How are you? Have you been all right through all those lonely, 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 lonely nights? That's what I'd say. I'd tell you everything if you'd pick up that telephone.
Oh, you don't even have to pick up the telephone. Big Brother is monitoring all of our communications now. And as if it's not enough. I mean, it was only 2 days ago, right here, that I confirmed to you via an FBI retiree talking about the Boston bombing case and whether or not Catherine Russell, the wife of Tamerlan Tsarnaev, had communicated with her husband before or after the bombing of the Boston Marathon. And the FBI guy said, oh, we've got all that stuff. You don't need to worry. And the CNN anchor was having a hard time buying it. Well, we know that all of our communications modes are subject to interception. We don't know exactly what happens to it, but we have a good, decent idea with the huge server farm that the NSA has recently constructed in Utah. And there are other server farms already in existence. And so going back to 9/11, perhaps before, virtually all of our electronic communications are captured and archived by the government. And I've told you that the Obama administration made an internal decision to extend the period of time that they collect electronic intel on persons who are innocent and never charged. It has been extended from 6 months to 5 years. And today, Charlie Savage in the New York Times reports that the Obama administration is on the verge of backing an FBI plan for a sweeping overhaul of surveillance laws that would make it easier to wiretap people who communicate using the Internet rather than by traditional phone services. FBI Director Robert S. Mueller III, who is in the 12th year of his statutorily limited 10-year term, that's right, he's on 2 years of overtime. It's supposed to expire in July, and I'm waiting for the move to say, oh, let's give him another 2 years. He's such a great spook. Well, Mueller has argued that the Bureau's ability to carry out court-approved eavesdropping is going dark as communications technology evolves. And since 2010, his push for a legal mandate requiring Facebook, Google, and others to build into their instant messaging and other systems a capacity to comply with wiretap orders, a backdoor. That proposal has bogged down amid concerns by other agencies about quashing Silicon Valley innovation. What about pissing off people like me who believe firmly in our Fourth Amendment rights? Oh, I guess that doesn't really matter. Gregory T. Nozheim of the Center for Democracy and Technology quoted, saying that, I think the FBI's proposal would render Internet communications less secure and more vulnerable to hackers and identity thieves. Andrew Weissman, general counsel of the FBI, said this doesn't create any new legal surveillance authority. This always requires a court order. That's what Bush said when he was violating the law on a massive scale before the retroactive legalization of the wiretap program in 2008, the so-called FISA reform law. A central element of the FBI proposal was to expand the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act that already requires phone and network carriers to build interception capabilities, a backdoor, into their systems. But the Bureau has now largely moved away from that one-size-fits-all mandate, and instead, the new proposal focuses on strengthening wiretap orders issued by judges. Currently, such orders instruct recipients to provide technical assistance to law enforcement, leaving wiggle room for companies to say, well, we tried, but we just couldn't manage to make the intercept work. Under the new proposal, no excuses will be accepted. Providers could be ordered to comply, and judges would impose fines if they did not, starting at $25,000 a day. And they also want to crack down on Skype and other voice-over IP systems that use packet technology that is harder to crack because the packets don't all take the same route from point A to point B. So, it's right out there in front of us. And if you're a conspiracy theorist, you could say, wow, they're taking advantage of the reaction to the Boston bombing to ram through another rollback in our privacy rights and our Fourth Amendment constitutional guarantees. But that would only be if, you know, you're a conspiracy theorist. Meanwhile, I want to thank one of my correspondents, Panama Alba in New York City, for forwarding a story from RT, that's Russian television. The group Anonymous has announced a hack attack in solidarity with the hunger strikers at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And they are calling on mass protests from May 17th to May 19th. Their online call for action condemned the U.S. for failing to deliver on Obama's promise to shut down Guantanamo. And the group describes the prison as a concentration camp, said that many of the inmates are being kept there despite having been cleared. That is true. Anonymous also lashed out at the Guantanamo administration for force-feeding some of the hunger strikers, which the UN recently condemned as torture and a breach of international law. They also expressed indignation on a practical level of how the facility, which they call a disgrace for any civilized country, is one of the most expensive prisons in the world. And this is the first time I've seen this figure, but it's in the right ballpark. It costs $900,000 a man every year to keep Guantanamo open. It's just another insult to our intelligence. So we'll be watching and seeing just how this hack attack rolls out, 17th to the 19th of May. On this program, we have frequently referred to the case of Don Siegelman, the former Democratic governor of Alabama, currently residing in a federal prison in Mississippi. Oh, no, he's actually in Louisiana, excuse me. He's in Louisiana. And most recently, we gave you our exclusive interview, the very first that his co-defendant Richard Scrushy has given since he left prison last year. Scrushy was interviewed yesterday at the Huffington Post in a live video conference, and he repeated many of the same arguments that he had raised in my conversation with him and Roger Shuler, the blogger from Alabama. And the reason Jeff Skilling comes up, he, of course, was the CEO of Enron, reporting to Kenny Boylay, George W. Bush's best friend forever. Kenny Boy died before he could be held accountable. And they threw the book at Jeff Skilling for the meltdown of Enron. I'm one of his victims. I had 100 shares of Enron, and I thought I was really clever. I bought it when Enron was part of the team that was blackmailing California and shutting down our power grid back in 2003-2004. And I thought, well, if we're going to pay through the nose to our utilities for electricity, maybe I can hedge that with a little profit-taking from the Buccaneers at Enron. Well, I bought it at 60. I sold it at 60 cents. But I've gotten over that. And now Jeff Skilling has made a deal with the government. And keep in mind that he was convicted under one of the laws that was used to railroad Don Siegelman and Richard Scrushy into prison. It's called the Honest Services Law. And the Supreme Court found problems with that law, and they ordered the lower courts to resentence Skilling and Scrushy and Siegelman. Three great guys whose names start with S. And finally, Skilling has a deal. He is going to get about 10 years off of his sentence. He'll be released perhaps in 2017. He will have served about 10 years at that point. He's going to cough up $40 million of forfeited assets and allow it to be distributed to victims. Maybe I'll get a nickel or two. And I'm not bitter about this. I think Skilling has been punished. And it's got to frost him that other white-collar criminals remain at large and getting paid heaping big bonuses. Those who melted down the economy in 2008. And, of course, it frosts me that Don Siegelman remains behind bars and Richard Scrushy once again very correctly states that he didn't get bribed by Siegelman didn't bribe Scrushy. Scrushy didn't bribe Siegelman. The story that was told in court is riddled with inaccuracies. The political railroading led by Karl Rove and his buddy Bill Canary and Bill's wife, the district attorney in Alabama, Lura Canary, a corrupt judge, Mark Fuller. You may have heard of all of this before. And so I hope that justice will be served in the Siegelman case. And it's time for the Obama administration to step up and stop ignoring it. And that's one of the issues that arose in the HuffPo chat with Mr. Scrushy. The judge who slammed the Obama administration and Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius over the political handling of the restrictions on the Plan B emergency contraceptive medication. It's not an abortion pill. Well, that judge, Edward R. Corman of the Eastern District of New York, is laying into the Obama team again. As you may know, he issued a ruling saying there is no excuse for any age restriction or a behind-the-counter restriction on the Plan B contraceptive. And he basically says that any woman of any age who is sexually active has a right to access this medication. And the Obama team filed a brief appealing his decision in the same 24-hour time period as the FDA released new regulations that moved the age from 17 to 15, and frankly, it's not clear to me whether they still want it behind the counter or if it can be sold with the flashlight batteries. But Judge Corman called the decision a lot of nonsense, the age 15 guideline, and he questioned its timing, made one day before the FDA filed its notice of appeal. Quote, I'm convinced the only reason you decided it when it was decided, was to sugarcoat this appeal. Right on, Judge. And, you know, the Obama administration should just accept this victory that's been handed to them. And they can say, well, you know, we didn't completely support this, but, hey, the judge made us do it. Instead, they keep the legal maneuvers going. Another useless hearing on Capitol Hill today before Darrell Issa's Government Oversight Committee in the House about Benghazi. And on the way to the studio this morning, I heard Mike Huckabee and Rusty Limbaugh once again railing about Benghazi. Now, one of the reasons that the right can do this is that there has been a cover-up. I think what they're covering up is that Benghazi was a big CIA post. And maybe some weapons were moving through there to, say, Syria or some other place, and they didn't want that exposed. And yes, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has attempted to skirt some of the issues of her own accountability for security in Benghazi and for the events of the fateful night last September 11th. And trotting out their alleged whistleblower, Gregory Hicks, who was on the scene in Benghazi, and has a pretty chilling story to tell. Republicans keep trying to insist that the U.S. military could have scrambled fighter jets and deployed combat forces to help fight off the militants. The nearest forces were in Italy, which is, to scramble, deploy, and get them to Benghazi, Libya, it's got to take 2 to 3 hours, minimum. And the battle was over before such reinforcements could be sent. That's my understanding of those events. And, you know, I give credit to Elijah Cummings, Democratic congressman from Maryland, who criticized Republicans and Chair Darrell Issa for distorting the facts of the investigation for partisan purposes. That is true, and that is a fair indictment of the Republicans. But as I've said before, this begs much bigger questions. If the Republicans want to exercise their oversight muscles, why don't they look at the big picture of why we were involved in Libya to begin with? And why taking out a vulnerable dictator just because we could was actually a bad idea? We're on the verge of trying a variation on that theme in Syria right now. You don't know what will follow in the vacuum created by the removal of a longtime dictator. And if they want to flex oversight muscles, why don't they look at Obama's drone program, at the targeted killings, at the domestic wiretapping? There are so many important issues. And these people only focus on things that they think will embarrass Democrats or promote the gun lobby. A couple of quickies. Mark Sanford, former governor of South Carolina, regained a House seat that he once held, was vacated, and a special election was held because the incumbent was appointed to the U.S. Senate seat. Musical chairs when Jim DeMint resigned from the Senate to head up the Heritage Foundation. And a lot of people were hoping that Stephen Colbert's sister, Elizabeth Colbert Bush, was going to defy the voter registration and the gerrymandering of this district and pull off an upset. And Sanford gave her a lot of opportunities. He was caught trespassing at his ex-wife's home. He's traipsing around with his mistress, now his fiance, in a kind of Newt Gingrich style. And, you know, he's a loony guy. But it's South Carolina, for Christ's sake. So I'm not surprised at that outcome. And he will be entertaining when he arrives in Washington shortly. Also, kudos to the great state of Delaware, becoming the 11th state in these United States to legalize marriage equality. The bill passed the legislature, and just an hour later, Democratic Governor Jack Markell signed it into law, quote, "I do not intend to make any of you wait one moment longer." And I'm hoping that this movement, now 11 states, is going to affect the Supreme Court decisions on both the Defense of Marriage Act and overturning California's anti-human rights law, Proposition 8. Yesterday, in our discussion of military sexual assault, I understated the survey results for the most recent year, which estimates the total number of sexual assault cases across all of the military branches. And I used the figure from last year of 19,000, but it has jumped up to 26,000. And while I am gratified to see more attention being paid to this and some fiery rhetoric from Senators Claire McCaskill and Kristen Gillibrand, we must insist that people be held accountable. We need to see some wayward men kicked out of the military. I was going to use a cruder term, but I thought better of it. Here in California, the battle over control of the state prison system continues. And once again, I cannot support Governor Jerry Brown's position. Last week, we told you about the long-term problem of valley fever, a fungal disease caused by inhaling spores from infected soil. It's prevalent in the Central Valley of California, where we have a number of prisons. And as you may know, due to overcrowding and the bad medical care that comes from overcrowding, a federal court placed the state prison system into receivership and under the control of a receiver named J. Clark Kelso. And Kelso, responding to the fact that 62 prisoners have died from valley fever in the last 7 years, ordered that 3,300 inmates from two prisons in the Central Valley be moved elsewhere. And the Brown administration says no. They filed a response in court on Monday saying that the directive is vague, premature, and legally unauthorized. Well, this is bullshit. Governor Brown, you have an obligation to protect the health and welfare, yes, even of convicted prisoners. They have constitutional rights. They have human rights. To try to pretend with 62 dead bodies caused by Valley Fever alone that this is not a significant problem, that is reprehensible. And I know you've got big problems trying to move all these prisoners around and comply with the federal court order to reduce the prison population, and that's not easy. But you could ease the pressure on the prison system by releasing thousands of aging life prisoners who are stuck on an open-ended sentence and the politicization of the parole process. These people do not reoffend. They have the lowest recidivism rate of any category of prisoner. And you could easily create the open slots in other prisons to move these 3,300 men who are susceptible to Valley Fever. They're predominantly African American and Filipino. They could be moved to other prisons. There's a hearing before Judge Thelton Henderson in San Francisco on June 17th, and I hope that that will come in time so that no additional lives will have been lost to Valley Fever. And finally today, just when you thought that Charlton Heston and Wayne LaPierre were the craziest gun huggers in these United States, the NRA produces a knuckle dragger who just lowers the bar in ways that no one could ever have expected. The new president of the NRA is Jim Porter. And he gave a speech last year to the New York Rifle and Pistol Association. And he's a Southern boy. While he was in New York, he said that the NRA was started in New York back in 1871 by some Yankee generals who didn't like the way my Southern boys had the ability to shoot in what we call the War of Northern Aggression. Now, y'all might call it the Civil War, but we call it the War of Northern Aggression down south. Well, you can call it whatever you want it, Jim Porter. But he goes on to say, that was the reason they started the NRA, to teach and train the civilian in the use of the standard military firearm. And I am one who still feels very strongly that that is one of our most greatest charges. Wow. English as a second language. I am one who still feels very strongly that this is one of our most greatest charges that we can have today, is to train the civilian in the use of the standard military firearm so that when they have to fight for the country, they're ready to do it. Also, when they're ready to fight tyranny, they're ready to do it. Also, when they're ready to fight tyranny, they have the wherewithal and the weapons to do it. Now, when they talk about tyranny, this is Sharon Angel or Angle. Remember her? She ran against Harry Reid for the Senate seat in Nevada. She talked about how people might need to use their Second Amendment remedies. These are thinly veiled talks about a right-wing armed insurrection in the United States. And at the NRA convention, I think it was in Dallas, it was somewhere in Texas last week, I didn't hear of anyone who said, you know, Jim Porter's a great guy, but I don't agree with what he says. No, they just got out their gun blue, polished their weapons, and hobnobbed with other gun-loving people. And to its credit, Amazon.com has removed the Target product. It was a Target sold to shooters for firing ranges in the form of a stuffed figure of a female. And when you succeed in hitting it, it bleeds. That was showcased at the NRA convention. And in just a few days, the opposition to it has caused Amazon to drop that from its product lineup. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. I hope you will share this podcast with a friend or maybe 10.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.